The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
Captain, I checked navigation 5 times the last hour. They swear up and down we're right on course. Looks more like the Bering Straits than the Gulf Stream to me. How far are we from the naval base?
ETA is 0100.
That's less than 2 hours.
Hope the Admiral's still up when we dock.
If I know the Admiral, he'll be waiting right there on the pier. You see anything, Kowalski?
No, sir. But if I spot an iceberg, don't be surprised.
Carry on.
Welcome, everyone. It is Thursday, March 23rd, 2023. I'm Bob Metz.
And I'm Robert Vaughn.
And this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online.
Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right wing, it's just right.
Fade into color, and color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
It seems almost incomprehensible to me that we should still find ourselves fretting about climate change. Well, at least of the climate change that pertains to weather. As I've been maintaining for years on the so-called issue of climate change, the real climate that is being changed is our political climate and everything else that goes with it. Nevertheless, most of today's conversation revolves around the science of climate change, something that is vitally necessary simply to counter the fake science being used for a political narrative. Our guest, Dr. Matthew Wielicke, certainly has the credentials and experience to challenge the fake narratives with the real science, which is exactly what he did in his March 13 conversation with Robert, available in its hour plus entirety on Just Right's various video channels. In our focus today, we'll be hearing about the Milankovitch cycles, the controversial status of CO2 as a greenhouse gas, the emerging competing theories about the origin of so-called fossil fuels, the known climate history of this planet revealing that ice at the poles is not typical, and many more insights and climate change nuances you may never have heard about before. All the latest, right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org, hear us on WBCQ and on Channel 292 Shortwave, follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform, and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible.
Now that we're on the outskirts of the COVID pandemic, we're now starting to see another fear-mongering arise, and that, of course, is climate change. And with me to discuss climate change is Dr. Matthew Wielicke of the University of Alabama. A good day, Doctor. How are you?
Hey, Robert. I'm well. Thanks for having me.
I wonder if you could just introduce yourself to our audience.
Yeah, sure. As you mentioned, my name is Dr. Matthew Wielicke. My background training is in biochemistry and cellular biology for my original degree. And then I shifted gears and got a PhD in geochemistry. I'm an isotope geochemist by training. I did that at my PhD at UCLA. And after postdocing there for a couple of years, I took a tenure track position at the University of Alabama in 2016. In the Department of Geological Sciences as an assistant professor. And I've been there ever since. And I'm in the process of leaving the University of Alabama at the end of this semester.
Could I ask you right off the bat whether or not this would be a fair comment to make? And it's in Dr. Christopher Essex's book with McKittrick co-authoring as Taken by Storm. And he has in his glossary of terms, it's actually a very funny book. He has a very dry and witty sense of humor here. He calls it the doctrine of certainty. And he says, the claim that we understand the climate, what is wrong with it, and how to fix it, and that one ought not to say otherwise in public. Is that a fair comment to make? I mean, there's so many experts out there saying that they know what the climate's doing, they know how to fix it, and nobody better say anything to the contrary.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely correct that we do not fully understand the coupled nonlinear chaotic climate system. So let's go through that. It's a coupled system, meaning that there's many different equations with many different variables that explain the system. Ideally, we'd love to have a single equation that can explain a system very nicely. But in such a dynamic system like climate, there's so many different equations and they all have different feedbacks. It's also nonlinear, meaning if you change one variable, you don't really know that you're going to get a proportional change in another variable. And the last part is that it's chaotic. Usually the way that we can predict things in the future is by seeing patterns in the past. And a chaotic system means that there's no recognizable patterns in the system, which makes the prediction of the future essentially non-deterministic. And so this whole idea that we can not only understand the climate system, but we can actually ascribe all of the changes to a single trace gas and some feedback loops that are associated with that trace gas is absolutely reductionist. It's non-scientific. And it's crazy that such a beautiful system and such a dynamic system like climate has been reduced down to a trace gas and anthropogenic emissions. And it's done to try to, in my mind, push policy. If you can reduce it to a single thing that you can go after and control, like anthropogenic emissions, you can drive policy decisions. But in terms of scientific analysis, it's absolutely true that this is such a complex system that the idea that we understand it, to me, it's ridiculous that people claim that we have a good understanding of this climate system, you know, maybe 50 good years of satellite data, and on a planet that's 4.5 billion years old.
Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson. Tonight has been a tough couple of years for the experts when it comes to big public policy questions, complicated adult stuff like war and disease and the economy, really the only things that matter. The assumption in Washington has for many years been that you should not worry about it. Don't sweat the details. That's not your role as a citizen and as a voter. We don't have that kind of democracy, the kind where you might actually participate. No, your job is to trust the experts and their conclusions and then obey them. But COVID kind of blew that up. If there's one thing we learned from that disaster, it's that public policy experts very often had no clue what they were talking about. Your hippie aunt in Mendocino County knew a lot more about how to beat a flu virus than your average virologist on CNN. Your aunt would tell you to go outside, get some exercise, some sunlight, some fresh air, stop eating junk food, turn off your computer once in a while, spend time with other people. Be healthy. That advice worked. The experts, by contrast, made you get the vaccine, and that did not work. So by March of 2021, people are starting to figure this out. Anyone who was paying attention in America understood that the experts, many of them, were full of it. And it was exactly at that moment that the Atlantic magazine in Washington published a piece pushing back against the growing consensus. That story was entitled, "Following Your Gut Isn't the Right Way to Go." It's hard to think of a funnier headline, really, mostly because it's so spectacularly absurd. You should always trust your gut. Obviously, it is the one thing that will never betray you. But the Atlantic magazine wanted you to know that your natural instincts are, in fact, worthless. The experts had a rough year, the magazine conceded, but we still have to trust them. Right. Actually, we don't have to trust them. And on big questions of public policy, we absolutely should not trust them. It's a democracy. But Washington is continuing to demand that we do trust them. Why? There may be a reason. Maybe COVID isn't the only big project they have in mind for us, a project the experts will justify on MSNBC. And indeed, it's not. There is the climate change agenda. And the climate change agenda is the single most ambitious effort to remake human civilization in all recorded history. And it's coming. In fact, it's already in progress. The only reason that millions and millions of Americans aren't protesting in the streets tonight over this effort to completely overturn their lives is that on some level, many people still do trust the experts, at least on climate change. But should they? We were pondering that this morning when we saw that the world's most famous climate change expert, Greta Thunberg of Sweden, just deleted a tweet she wrote in June of 2018. Here it is, quote, "A top climate scientist is warning that climate change will wipe out all of humanity unless we stop using fossil fuels over the next 5 years." The scientist, of course, was a Harvard professor, so obviously that prediction was going to be correct. But here we are still driving our Silverados and still alive, and some of us are still happy. So it does make you wonder if Greta Thunberg, the greatly revered Greta Thunberg, a perennial finalist for the Nobel Peace Prize, could have gotten that so wrong. What else have the climate experts gotten wrong? And how long have they been getting it wrong? Well, fortunately, the Competitive Enterprise Institute has done the research on this, and it turns out these people have been very wrong for a very long time. 1969, the New York Times was printing climate hysteria from an expert called Paul Ehrlich. Quote, "We must realize that unless we are extremely lucky, everybody will disappear in a cloud of blue steam in 20 years. That was Paul Ehrlich in 1969. Well, here it is, 2023, and that same Paul Ehrlich, who's now 90 and still publishing books and still being cited on 60 Minutes, is still telling us that we're all going to die. Now, clearly, Paul Ehrlich had some sort of traumatic childhood he's been inflicting on the rest of us for over 50 years. And for over 50 years, his fellow experts have taken him seriously. Now, back then, of course, climate change didn't mean global warming. It meant a new ice age. In 1970, the Boston Globe reported, quote, "Scientists predict a new ice age by 21st century. According to the Globe, air pollution may obliterate the sun and cause a new ice age in the first third of the next century." An ice age. In 1972, Brown University's science department sent a letter to the White House explaining that they had deep concern with the future of the world because this ice age falls within the rank of processes which produced the last ice age. 2 years later, 1974, The Guardian reported that, quote, "Spy satellites show new ice age is coming fast." And the report cited, just for moral weight, analysis carried out at Columbia University. Then, a few years later, 1977, the actor Leonard Nimoy was not a science expert technically, but played one at one point on television, shot this video.
"We are unprepared for the next advance. The result could be hunger and death on a scale unprecedented in all of history. What scientists are telling us now is that the threat of an ice age is not as remote as they once thought. During the lifetime of our grandchildren, Arctic cold and perpetual snow could turn most of the inhabitable portions of our planet into a polar desert."
Hunger and death on an unprecedented scale. Someone else with the tragic childhood he inflicted on the rest of us.
We're still putting 162 million tons into it every single day. And the accumulated amount is now trapping as much extra heat as would be released by 600,000 Hiroshima-class atomic bombs exploding every single day on the Earth. That's what's boiling the oceans, creating these atmospheric rivers and the rain bombs and sucking the moisture out of the land and...
How dare you? You have stolen my dreams and my childhood with your empty words, and yet I'm one of the lucky ones. People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
Given people like Al Gore, a politician, Greta Thunberg, an actress and politician, I guess you'd say, saying that you stole my childhood, how dare you? We really have nothing to fear. Is that a fair statement?
I think that, you know, being concerned with the environment and making sure that we are good stewards of the land is a really good idea. If people think that humanity is in danger because of a couple degrees of warming by 2100, I think that, first of all, that really kind of reduces humans' ingenuity. We're such an ingenuitive species. We have technology. We solve so many of our problems. It's a very privileged concern to have, to be thinking of a couple degrees at 2100 when there's over 2 billion people on the planet that don't have access to clean drinking water. I think that, you know, we have problems on the planet that we can solve. A couple degrees of warming in 2100 is somewhere at the bottom of the list of problems.
To that point about the people living in poverty and not having clean drinking water, we can talk a little more about the politics of this, but just right off the top, it does seem to be an agenda for the first world countries to alter their consumer and industrial behavior. which, of course, if that was the case for the developing world, first of all, they wouldn't do it. And secondly, it would be destructive, wouldn't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is partially green colonialism. We outsource all of these raw materials. We don't actually stop purchasing these things. We still want all of our technologies and our iPhones and things like that. And so we let countries with very little environmental protections, very few human rights protections, essentially mine this material for us. And then we walk around and pat each other on the back in a developed world to say, look, we've reduced our CO2 emissions by this much because we've essentially outsourced all of our raw materials and all of our energy production. And we still actually consume all of that stuff. But now it's being mined in cobalt mines in the Congo by children while we enjoy the low cost of that and pat each other on the back. It's not sustainable. It's not a healthy way to try to solve environmental problems. I think the legacy of this big revolution is going to be the exploitation of the developing world to try to basically decarbonize the Western world, which is now producing way less carbon than, for example, China and India, and will be producing less than sub-Saharan Africa when that starts to finally develop. And so it's a strange way to try to virtue signal that, you know, you're somehow saving the planet when you just kind of don't witness the living conditions of some of these folks that are getting the raw materials for a lot of this new technology that we so desperately want and think is going to help the planet.
Words certainly have meaning when you're talking in a political context. It seems that they're always trying to redefine words. Another word is organic. Now, I took organic chemistry in university, and you have a degree in it, biochemistry. The word organic simply means having a carbon molecule. And so I've been taking to tweeting out that we should all be using organic fuel.
You know, it is organic
oil,
fuel.
Gas.
It is organic. Absolutely, it's organic fuel.
Now, I don't know. There's two theories as to where our oil and gas comes from. Is it organic? Is it plant and animal material that over millennia or eons been compressed under high pressure and now we're extracting it? Or is it typical in a planet like this? Now, you would be an expert on something like that, I would imagine.
Yeah, so I talk a lot about this. So there's good answers on both sides. So the history of this is actually the Ukrainian and Russian scientists back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s had the abiotic origin of fossil fuels. I guess we just call them hydrocarbons because their claim is that they're not related to fossils. And they came up with some interesting theories. These are called Fischer-Tropsch reactions. We can replicate them in the lab. We know they exist. It's a relatively efficient way to make things like methane. So there's definitely an abiotic way to make some of our hydrocarbons. This is why if you look at the moon of Saturn called Titan, there's actually lakes of ethane and methane. And we think we understand the photochemistry that's happening in the atmosphere there that's creating these small chain hydrocarbons. So remember methane, right? That's single carbon with four hydrogens. Ethane, these are very small, short hydrocarbon chains. To make the hydrocarbons that we're going to mainly, what we mainly talk about is crude oil, we're talking about a much longer hydrocarbon chain. It seems that the best evidence we have for the hydrocarbon reservoirs that we have on Earth is that they are the remnants of little buggers that were living in shallow seas that die off, and as they sink, they get buried, and they get warmed up to about 80 or so, 90 degrees Celsius. They're fossilized little skeletons will start to break down and turn into a waxy substance we call kerogen. And then about at 120 degrees, you can make oil. At about 150 degrees, you make natural gas. And there's a few things that lead us to believe that. One is the carbon isotopes. So carbon comes in a few different isotopes. There's carbon-14 that a lot of us have heard about because that's how we carbon date things. That's the radioactive one. But there's actually two stable ones, carbon-12, which is the majority of carbon, and carbon-13. And organisms tend to prefer using carbon-12 because nature is cheap, essentially. And if you can use less energy to move this carbon around to make your tissues and your skeleton and everything else as a carbon-based organism, you're going to preferentially use the 12. And so what we see is that there is this preferential use of 12 and this exclusion of carbon-13. And we don't see that in natural processes. For example, carbonate rocks, or for example, the Fischer-Tropsch reactions that we can make in a lab. And so I really hope that the abiotic theory is correct, because that means there would be more fossil fuels out there. I think that every oil and gas company hopes that they're correct. But from the fact that we almost always have to find these deposits in what we can tell by other geologic evidence used to be the remnants of shallow seas because of these carbon isotope signatures, I'm pretty convinced that these are remnants of fossils. Coal, we can clearly see the actual plant matter still, because coal is actually swamps that were now compacted. And there we can actually still see some plant matter. So that one I think we're pretty confident in. But you don't see the fossils really left in the hydrocarbon reservoirs. They've all been broken down by that process that I was talking about. I really hope the abiotic theory is correct, but I would argue that the evidence that we have so far in the hydrocarbon reservoirs we've found on Earth, it seems that these are the remnants of fossils. There seems to be a biotic origin.
I'm with you. For an abiotic origin, you would then expect perhaps some hydrocarbons on other planets and moons. Although I would imagine tectonic shift is really important to the production of the hydrocarbons.
You're going to need some tectonics, because you need burial. And so you need to lift some surfaces up, have some weathering processes that will now bury that material. That's where you're going to get your heat and your pressure from, is this burial process.
And since there's very little tectonic activity on any other body in our solar system that we're aware of, at least, I guess it's a pipe dream to think that we can dig down in Mars or the moon and find oil and gas.
Yeah. I mean, Mars may be, because it was had water, or the theory is it had some water in those first few hundred million years. That would be the only place. But man, that's a real short amount of time to develop the life necessary to get going. So I can't imagine that that's a possibility.
I've heard that ice at the poles on Earth is not usual. It's not typical, given the 4.5 billion years we've been around, or say 4 billion years since life first evolved on the planet. Would you agree that ice at the poles is not typical?
Yeah, absolutely. So what I try to focus on what's known as the Phanerozoic. So that's the last 550 million years. That's the time period. Phanero, it means visible, and zoic is life. So this is the time period of visible life. This is a time period where animals on the planet developed hard parts. So we started to get teeth and shells and bones. And that's a lot better to fossilize. And so we have a really good idea of kind of the life's evolution for the last 550 million years, or the fossil record is really pretty good throughout that time. And we really have a good idea of the temperature proxies throughout that time, because one thing that we're always doing when we're looking at fossils is we're trying to figure out the environment that those fossils and those animals lived in. And if you look at the last 550 million years, the vast majority, something like over 70%, closer to 80% of that time, there was no ice on the poles at all. In fact, that's the normal state of the planet in the last 550 million years. The average atmospheric CO2 was on the order of 1500 ppm. There was no ice at the poles. This was a time period where we know plants were the most successful they've ever been, because we call this the Carboniferous. This is a time period on the order of about 300 million years ago, where there was so much plant matter on the surface of the Earth that that's where the majority of our coal deposits are dated to. So most of the coal that we find today and use came from this time period when the average atmospheric CO2 was 1600 ppm. There was no ice on either pole. And so, you know, this idea that the current state of the climate has to be the perfect state and it has to be the way that it stays forever, it's just not supported by geologic history. The fact that humans evolved and that we built some coastal cities isn't going to stop the planet from changing and being dynamic. We're going to have to accept to live with that and adapt. And we're really good at that. We have good technologies, and you know, there will be challenges. But the idea that somehow what we see currently is what we're going to keep forever, because otherwise we'll be inconvenienced, just isn't supported in the geologic record. We should expect that there will be another time period relatively soon, in geologically speaking, where the poles won't have ice, because if we look in the past, that seems to be the most common state of the planet over the last 550 million years.
Well, I can understand why some people may be concerned if they live in the north, for example, on the permafrost. And if that permafrost starts to melt, it's going to cause consternation. It's going to cause people concern about their houses. But, you know, people adapt, as you've said before. People adapt. People are brilliant at adapting. That's what we do. I mean, after having evolved as a species in Africa, we now occupy every single corner of the globe because we adapt. So do you think it's rather disingenuous of people like a Greta Thunberg or a United Nations spokesman to come out and say that we have to stop using organic fuels, hydrocarbons, otherwise the polar bears will die off and Aboriginals will have to learn how to live on a muddier permafrost, which is no longer permanent, or that Obama's going to have to move his house in a few hundred feet from the coast? You know, these inconveniences to a lot of politicians outweigh, I would say, death that would result from us transitioning away from a hydrocarbon world. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I think it's very disingenuous. This is this whole idea that things would just be stable if we didn't burn fossil fuels. And that is absolutely against the geologic record. The idea that we won't have a warming spell, or we won't have a hurricane or a flood. And IPCC is guilty of this too, because if you look at the IPCC reports, they claim that there's zero natural forcing right now. And everything that we see is attributable to anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions. That would suggest to me that if I looked back in history prior to the Industrial Revolution, I should see in the geologic record that CO2 and temperature are stable. Because there's no humans burning anthropogenic CO2s, if there's no natural forcing, things should be stable. We see the exact opposite. We see major swings from glacials to interglacials. We see hothouses and ice houses. The climate's never stable. And so the claim that everything that we see today and every negative consequence of every weather event is somehow directly attributable to anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions is unscientific, it's disingenuous, it's a way to fearmonger and to drive up anxiety, because if you can get folks anxious about this, it's easier to change their behavior. I agree with you, it's totally disingenuous.
Never in the history of humanity has compliance and cowardice and simply just doing what you're told been heroic and virtuous, except during COVID. Don't question, just do exactly what you're told. You're a hero now. Absolutely ludicrous, but it worked. It worked because a lot of people were looking for any excuse to comply, because just like I said, I didn't want any of the attention, so I know exactly how everybody else felt. But it needed to be done, and it still needs to be done, because they haven't stopped. This entire COVID operation was literally to prime you for what they're doing now with the climate change agenda, because they knew the average person wasn't going to say, oh, I'll give up my car and give up my house and give up my traveling around the world for the good of the climate. Nobody cared. No one thinks you're actually going to die if you don't stop eating meat in 30 years. Nobody believes that crap. So they can't get you to go along with it. They can't get you to volunteer. But with COVID, oh my gosh. Now, if you didn't go along with it, you're killing grandma. You're killing babies. They're making you feel as guilty as possible. There was two fundamental things they wanted to do with COVID. The first one being to get rid of the notion that individual rights and freedoms are paramount to a successful society, which we know is reality because we've had world wars and millions of people fighting and dying to preserve individual rights and freedoms. That's how important they have been to society. But in COVID, within just a few weeks, individual rights and freedoms were not just no longer paramount to a successful society, they were selfish and dangerous. And those who would fight for rights and freedoms were not patriotic. They were not heroes. Now they were domestic terrorists. That was a huge, huge fundamental shift in human thought and human consciousness that they perpetrated on the entire world after generations and generations of believing one way. Within a few months, weeks, in fact, 2 weeks to flatten the curve, it took them that's all it took to reprogram billions and billions of people to now loathe rights and freedoms and attack those that were trying to protect their rights and freedoms. The second thing that they needed to do was to get rid of the notion of individual responsibility, because individual responsibility leads to independence. Independence leads to freedom. So they need you to get used to the idea of collective responsibility. It's straight out of every communist playbook, straight out of every Marxist playbook. This way, now, the government and everybody else are partially responsible for every decision you make. So now the government's involved in every aspect of your life. Nobody would have agreed to this, except with COVID. So now, 2 years later, we went from a society where individual rights and freedoms were paramount to a successful society, to now rights and freedoms are selfish and dangerous. And we went to the fact that we have collective responsibility. So now I need to wear my mask to protect you. You need to wear your mask to protect grandma. We're all in this together. That whole garbage bullshit. And what does that prime us for? That primes us perfectly for the next phase. The next phase of programming, which is the climate change agenda. Because a pandemic can only last for so many years. The climate change agenda can last for generations. And in order for you to accept and volunteer for climate change servitude, we needed to get rid of the notion of individual rights and freedoms, and we needed to install the notion of collective responsibility.
By the early 1980s, when the ice didn't arrive, well, the experts decided the problem wasn't too much cold, it was too much heat. It was global warming. In 1989, the Associated Press ran this story, quote, a senior UN environmental official says entire nations could be wiped off the face of the earth by rising sea levels if global warming trend is not reversed by the year 2000. In other words, 23 years ago. That same year, 1989, a climate expert called Jim Hansen met with a reporter from Ceylon. According to Ceylon, Hansen explained that within 20 or 30 years, quote, the West Side Highway, which runs along the Hudson River in Manhattan, will be underwater. Underwater. We checked tonight, and actually it's congested, but still a road. Then in March of 2000, the Independent newspaper ran a piece explaining that snowfalls are now just a thing of the past. And we're quoting, snow is starting to disappear from our lives. The piece quoted a climate expert claiming that, quote, children just aren't going to know what snow is. No idea what snow is. It'll be a relic, not of the ice age, but of the great inferno of global warming. Then in 2004, amazingly, civilization still existed. The Guardian predicted that, quote, major European cities will be sunk beneath rising seas as Britain is plunged into a Siberian climate by 2020, which is a little confusing because global warming doesn't typically produce a Siberian climate. And it was around this time that they decided, hey, we don't want to get pinned down on the details. Will it be too hot? Will it be too cold? We don't want to say. Something bad's going to happen, so we're going to call it climate change. And that paved the way for Al Gore, who in 2006 released his famous documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. And the beauty of An Inconvenient Truth is now that it's been, well, inconveniently more than 15 years since it came out, we can fact check its claims. Here's the trailer.
If you look at the 10 hottest years ever measured, they've all occurred in the last 14 years. And the hottest of all was 2005. This is Patagonia, 75 years ago, and the same glacier today. This is Mount Kilimanjaro, 30 years ago, and last year. Within the decade, there will be no more snows of Kilimanjaro.
Al Gore also said there would be no ice in the Arctic. He quoted researchers, climate researchers, experts, and he explained that, quote, the North Pole will be ice-free in the summer by 2013 because of man-made global warming. Now, it does take a certain level of chutzpah to make a prediction that precise, and Al Gore made many of them, and all of them turned out to be wrong. And for a normal person, that would be a cue, well, maybe it's time to retire. I'm rich on Google stock, maybe I could just stop talking because, of course, I've been disgraced by my own foolish predictions. But no, he kept going. And he was helped in that by the entire news media. It makes you wonder why. News organizations exist to bring you the news, to assess whether things are true or not. But if all of them collude to hide lying, you have to ask, is there something else going on here? We'll let you decide. We do know that by 2006, NBC News informed the world that, quote, a leading U.S. climate researcher says the world has a 10-year window till 2016, a window of opportunity to take decisive action on global warming and avert catastrophe. Well, of course, by their predicted date, Donald Trump became president, but that's not what they were predicting. In 2008, the Associated Press reported that according to a top NASA scientist, in 5 to 10 years, the Arctic will be free of sea ice in the summer. That didn't happen, but of course, no one was ever held to account for bad predictions, so this kept going. John Kerry, now our climate czar, cited that very same science in 2009. Watch.
You have sea ice, which is melting at a rate that the Arctic Ocean now increasingly is exposed. In 5 years, scientists predict we will have the first ice-free Arctic summer.
What's hilarious is this is a guy who's never had a job. He's only been in politics. He's never done one useful thing. He's not a scientist. He's never done research. He's actually not an expert, but because he's way more aggressive than you are, and because he has access to the media, which amplify his claims, he poses as one. Now, what's strange about the prediction you just heard is that John Kerry's prediction contradicts Barack Obama's famous climate prediction from a year earlier. You probably remember this.
Because if we are willing to work for it and fight for it and believe in it, then I am absolutely certain that generations from now, we will be able to look back and tell our children that this was the moment when we began to provide care for the sick and good jobs to the jobless. This was the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and our planet began to heal.
Sad to watch that, all the cheering people, they seem so sincere. He's going to save the world. He can control the weather. He's Jesus. But in fact, the global healing Obama promised at the beginning of his first term never came, and neither did the global destruction. Here, by the way, is Neil deGrasse Tyson, another great predictor of things, saying that by 2014, the Statue of Liberty will soon be underwater.
You know what I tell people? This wakes them into, here in the New York metropolitan area, I say, you know, if we lose the ice caps, you know how high the water will be? I say, oh, maybe a couple of feet. No, it would come up to the Statue of Liberty's elbow, the one that's holding the Declaration of Independence. That's where the water line will be.
That man's a scientist.
You are listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online.
Can you talk a bit about the Milankovitch cycles and how it correlates with the climate changes we're seeing over millennia?
Sure. So Milankovitch cycles are named after an Eastern European astronomer who started to identify that there were some orbital forcing that people weren't really thinking about. And so one of them we call the eccentricity. So you have the sun, and the Earth doesn't go perfectly around the sun. Sometimes its orbit is a little wonky, and we can see this on the order of about tens to hundreds of thousands of year timescales where the orbit changes its shape a little bit. And obviously, the closer you are to the sun, the more solar radiation you get, the farther away you are, the less. Another one is that the tilt of the Earth changes. We call that the obliquity. And so we're on a tilt of something like 19 or so, or 23 degrees. Don't quote me on that, somewhere in that ballpark. But that tilt isn't always stable, and there's a little bit of movement in that tilt. And then because we're tilted but we're spinning, the top actually precesses. We call that the precession. So think about a spinning top as it's slowing down. You kind of get this precession. And all of these things will affect the amount of solar radiation that is being absorbed by Earth's surface. And that's the number one driving heat source for the atmosphere, is the amount of solar radiation. We're talking something about 1,000 watts per meter squared at the surface. So if you start to affect those, and those have all kind of tens to 100,000 year timescales, every once in a while, they will kind of synchronize, right? They can be off at some points, but because they're cyclical, there's these time periods where they synchronize, and those time periods, when they synchronize, they tend to correlate really well to how we observe our interglacial and glacial cycles moving. And it seems that when these things all come together in terms of a negative forcing, so they're all working to reduce the amount of solar radiation that the Earth is receiving, then we plunge ourselves into a glacial cycle. When these things are a little bit wonky and not all lined up, we come out and we're in an interglacial cycle, and then we plunge back down. And so it appears that it's these orbital forcings that are really been driving the rapid swings that we've been observing over the last million or so years that we see with the ice core data, for example, from Antarctica.
Well expressed. So I think people, if they don't have that word on their mind very often, they should find out about it, Milankovitch cycles, because it seems to be perhaps the main, grossly, and I mean by that, again, thousands of years, climate change or temperatures that we seem to be experiencing is because of our non-circular orbit around the sun and the perturbations of that orbit. You know, I took a course in, at the time they called it ecology. I think it was 1979, 1980 at university. And we were shown the graph, which shows carbon dioxide going up and up and up in a steady climb. And of course, the professor at the time was trying to instill in us a sort of a cautionary fear about man's contribution to that. Now, I only know very, very superficially about climate change and the science, probably more than your average beer, but a lot less than a lot of people. And I have heard that CO2 levels increase as a result of rising temperatures on the planet, with a lag of about 600 years. It's almost like, well, it comes out of the oceans. An analogy, perhaps a poor analogy, would be releasing the cork on a pop bottle, and it comes out of solution into the atmosphere. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's still debatable over the last glacial period, but there's pretty good evidence that the four earliest glacial cycles, what we see is temperature rise, and then there is on the order of a few centuries of a lag, and we start to see CO2 rise. I think you're absolutely correct. It's likely that as temperatures go up, the oceans warm, and due to Henry's law, the amount of gas you can dissolve in a liquid has a temperature dependence. The oceans are by far the largest reservoir of CO2, so gentle warming of the oceans forces CO2 out of solution, thus CO2 starts to increase in the atmosphere. One of the arguments is that, well, if we're putting some CO2 out into the atmosphere and that drives a little bit of warming, then the oceans are releasing another big chunk of it as well. So you can't claim that the current 422 ppm or so is purely anthropogenic emissions. The argument back is that the oceans are now, they claim, a sink of carbon dioxide. It's actually removing carbon dioxide while it's warming. I argue that that violates Henry's law, because of the temperature dependence of a solution. But there has been this lag over the majority of the ice core data that we see. There is on the order of a few centuries lag, and it varies between ice cores. But it's pretty clear that temperatures rise first, and CO2 is a response to that temperature increase.
Isn't that interesting? Then politicians in the United Nations, the IPCC and all that, turn it around. They say CO2 is a greenhouse gas. We're releasing CO2 through the burning of fossil fuels. So therefore, we're driving temperature increase when, just as with most everything we've discovered in the last few years, everything's flipped on its head. They're exactly the opposite. Again, how do they get away with this nonsense?
Yeah, well, if they were more open about, and I mean, they play some tricks now with the last glacial cycle. So the last glacial cycle gets debated a lot. Some people are now claiming that they have evidence that the CO2 started to rise. But if temperatures rise and everybody knows that temperatures go up first and CO2 comes out as a response, it's much harder to pin everything onto this trace gas that you can control. So it definitely goes against the narrative. So it's one of these subjects that, you know, the climate scientists don't really want to discuss. If you bring that up to a lot of folks, they'll say, well, that's what in the past, we know what's happening today. And my argument always is, well, as any earth scientist, because climate scientists is earth science, really, as any earth science knows, that the way we know what's happening today is by looking at what happened in the past. And if we look at what happened in the past, there's a clear lag you know, of CO2 response to temperature rise. And that doesn't mean that CO2 is not a greenhouse gas. I think there's quite a few good experiments now that show that it does trap IR, infrared radiation. How it re-radiates back and the clear effects of temperature, I think, are still very hotly debated. It also is logarithmic in terms of its forcing. And so, you know, people think that, oh, if we double CO2, that's going to have a doubling of a temperature effect. That's not actually true because it's rolled over quite a bit already. And so there's quite a few folks, at good atmospheric scientists, that would argue that doubling to 800 would result in maybe a degree of warming, which I would argue will be a net benefit for the planet than a net negative.
About the greenhouse effect and calling CO2 a greenhouse gas. However, I know what you're saying. As a greenhouse gas, it absorbs or prevents the release of infrared radiation out of the atmosphere. But again, I'm going to quote from Chris Essex, or Professor Chris Essex at the University of Western Ontario, Department of Applied Mathematics, now retired. He says, under the greenhouse effect, the term applied to describe the action of infrared absorbing gases in the atmosphere, though the process in that case is quite different in greenhouses. Energy drain from the turbulent fluid dynamics is impeded by a physical barrier in a greenhouse, you know, an actual greenhouse, requiring increased radiative drain and a higher air temperature. There's no such impedance to turbulent motions in the atmosphere. So he's making a very clear distinction between a greenhouse, an actual physical greenhouse, and the gases inside of it, because they're up against a physical barrier, and the planet as a whole, because we have an open-ended atmosphere, you know, which sort of peters away into space, you know, hundreds of kilometers above us. So is there something to what he's saying here, trying to make that distinction? Is it accurate to call CO2 in relation to the atmosphere a greenhouse gas in that respect?
Correct. A physical barrier is going to be the main driver in terms of energy loss in a greenhouse. And the gas really is a secondary player, mainly, like he says, to turbulent forces. But I would still argue that we have pretty good evidence that CO2 will slow IR release from the surface, and that should have some energy imbalance, that it's adding some energy into the atmosphere. And how the atmosphere dissipates that energy, there's still quite a bit of debate, whether it just radiates a little bit more to space, or whether that's trapped as actual heat. I think there's quite a bit of debate, but I think it's become one of these terms that it's easier to talk to the public and say greenhouse, because a lot of people have walked into a greenhouse, even though the effect isn't actually on par with what's happening in the natural atmosphere. When water vapor is by far the number one greenhouse gas, but adding gases that will absorb infrared radiation coming off the surface can slow the heat release from the surface.
Would it be a significant difference?
That's a great question. And so when I learned about atmospheric physics back when I was doing my PhD, we were told that on the order of 90 to 95% of the greenhouse gas effect is water vapor.
So now the next phase is 15-minute cities, personal carbon allowances, and people write those words down, digital IDs, digital currency, and then finally, they're going to connect this all with a universal basic income that people are going to require, because they're going to use a combination of an increase in cost of living due to inflation highly outpacing wages and supplemental income, combined with a whole new system of taxing you in the name of saving the planet. So now we're at phase three. Individual rights and freedoms are selfish and dangerous. And now you have to give them up, not for your health and safety and not just temporarily because of a pandemic. Now you have to give them up forever and for the good of so-called Mother Earth. See how they tiptoe you to tyranny? It's always one step at a time. A 15-minute city means that everything you need is going to be a 15-minute walk or bike ride. Why don't they mention cars? Because the whole purpose of a 15-minute city is to eliminate cars. If you see any renderings of what a 15-minute city is supposed to look like, you'll notice there's two things, or there's not two things. You'll notice no single-family dwellings with garages anywhere, only mixed-use buildings where you have commercial at the bottom and residential on top, because they want you to live and work in the same building, so you don't even have to leave the building for most of your life, let alone leave the block or your 15-minute city district. The other thing you're not going to see in their renderings are cars anywhere. You're going to see people on bikes, scooters, you're going to see public transit. And there's a reason for this. If you look up 15-minute city in Google and define what it is, the very first thing that every single publication will admit is that the primary purpose of a 15-minute city is to reduce the individual's carbon footprint.
And of course, climate does change. It has always changed. In fact, the landscape we live in now is formed by climate change. The glaciers are a product of climate change. The climate is changing now. It never stops changing. That is a process that we didn't cause and that we can't control to any great degree. We'll never be able to control. And there are upsides to it and downsides to it. By the way, if the Earth is indeed getting warmer, and it seems to be, well, then that will make more arable land in places like Canada and Northern Europe. So like everything in this life, in the temporal world, it's a mixed blessing. But you only hear the downsides, which tells you a lot. It tells you this is not science, it's manipulation. These aren't reports from the experts. These are threats. Here's Joe Biden.
That's what climate change is about. It is literally, not figuratively, a clear and present danger. The latest climate report, nothing less than, quote, code red for humanity. Let me say it again. Code red for humanity.
Code red for humanity. Of course, he never explains what that means. You're going to have to check your book of science to find out. Of course, in the details, they don't offer as many details now because they've all been wrong. But to the extent they do, they are provably wrong over time. So the question is, why are we still being bullied by these people? It has nothing to do with saving the Earth. They hate the Earth. They hate nature. It's about controlling us. And maybe we should recognize that.
You know, there's a quote, I got this directly from the United Nations website after I typed in climate change in the United Nations. It says, quote, since the 1800s, to go to what you're saying, human activities have been the main driver of climate change, primarily due to burning fossil fuels like coal, oil, and gas. So exactly what you just said. They think that prior to 1800, everything was perfectly stable, which, as you've pointed out, is not true. So how did they get away with this nonsense, this unscientific, patently false claim that we are the main driver of climate change?
Yeah, it's strange how it's evolved. If you start to see some of the first IPCCs, the language is very soft. It's, you know, well, we may be a major contributor and we should be concerned. And over the last few IPCCs, it's really shifted to this, no, we're certain it's just purely us, and we know and we can understand the whole system. And yet, you know, we look around, and if we go by the metrics of things like, for example, human loss of life from natural disasters or costs, we're not seeing these things increase. And so the planet's warming. I think that a lot of the way they get away with this is they look at ice core data from Antarctica. So Antarctica has the ice cores that NASA likes to use, or Al Gore, and they show these fluctuations between something like 180 or 200 ppm up to about 300 and never above 300. And one thing about Antarctic ice is that Antarctica is a desert. And so the ice takes hundreds, if not thousands, of years to form. And so what it really does is it kind of mutes the signal of global CO2. One thing that I like to talk about is plant stomata. These are little breathing holes on plant leaves and needles. The density of these plant stomata is directly proportional to the amount of CO2. If you look at that data, it looks very different than the ice core data. In fact, it has large fluctuations of over 200 ppm in the matter of a decade, much more than we've seen in our burning of fossil fuels. And so if you can find a muted signal and then you tack on modern observations to that, you can show this hockey stick graph, right, that's become famous with Michael Mann and the original, some of the original IPCC reports. But the truth is that you're splicing something that doesn't pick up short-term changes very well because of how the ice cores form, or for example, tree rings, which was the original IPCC report. And then you're splicing on modern observations that are very accurate and are, you know, on a real short time series and picking up very short-term variations. And then you try to splice those together. And so I would call that scientifically irresponsible, but that's essentially how they've gotten away with this claim that everything that we see today in terms of rising CO2 is purely anthropogenic, even though I've got clear data sets that show with plant stomata that it was up to 350, 380. Now we're at 420. And I think that human burning of fossil fuels is definitely contributing to the amount of CO2 that's in the atmosphere. But the claim that it's all 100% suggests that it's been stable. And we just know that's not true. And so I think that they've gotten a little bit more desperate in the words they've been using because people aren't changing. We've had 27 of these COP meetings. There's been six IPCC reports since 1990. And if you look at CO2 on a plot from Mauna Loa, there's no slowing it. It continues to rise. And I feel that they're getting more and more desperate, and their wording has gotten more and more catastrophic and certain in terms of what they think they know and how bad it's going to be, because they're ultimately trying to push policy.
Well, of course. I think maybe we can end off with a political question, and that would be how to get this out there. How do we counter that false narrative?
Yeah, it's a tough question. It makes it even harder when you see folks from the UN saying that they own the science, they own the information. I think the more times we see, and COVID, I think, really opened people's eyes, the more times the government tells us that this is misinformation and it turns out to be true, the less trusting we are of folks like that. And I think that people are starting to, especially after COVID, to ask more questions and not be afraid to ask more questions and, you know, start to think about their lived experience. And hey, as more and more predictions don't come true, as they become more desperate and claiming everything we talk about is misinformation and then eventually is proven correctly, you know, it's an uphill battle, but I think people are getting fed up with it. I think things like, you know, having conversations like me and you are having, I'm really hoping that the tide is turning and, you know, it's going to be an uphill battle because, like you said, they have the power right now. It really wears on you to constantly be thinking about terrible catastrophes and the doom and gloom of the future. You know, people start to realize that's not healthy for their mental health. And I hope that the tides are starting to change, but it's going to be a continued uphill slog. But I think it's worth it.
Yeah, wonderful. I'm thankful for what you've done and for your outspokenness and your truthfulness. We have to get the message out. I thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, Robert.
Whether it's the climate science or the political science, the principles are the same. Accurate knowledge demands accurate definitions, contexts, evidence, and an open forum within which all points of view can be discussed, debated, accepted, or refuted, as they will continue to be when you join us again next week as we continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
As a former member of Her Majesty's Secret Service, of course, I'm obliged to keep the strictest secrecy, so whatever I say from this podium to this gathering must not exceed the bounds of Marble Arch. So shall I trust you in secrecy? Shall I? Then be forsworn. Over the past 10 years, those of us in national security have grown increasingly concerned about knife crime, jihadi terrorism, the perennial grooming gangs. But we've grown increasingly concerned that people aren't concerned about climate change anymore. And therein lied the match that struck the spark, that created the flame, that became known as the Greta Thunberg Project.